This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to speak with renowned civil rights attorney Flint Taylor in Chicago. He's recently written about the power of police unions. Police unions are a hidden history in this whole struggle, and we need to know what they do and how they do it.
After the USA Patriot Act became law, photographing federal buildings raised alerts by law enforcement. But the practice is far from illegal. In fact, many citizens engage in what's called First Amendment auditing. We'll hear how important this is for preserving our rights to free speech and freedom of the press. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
When they commit violence against civilians, abusive police in the United States are protected in various ways. The power elite, whose property police protect, have given them almost complete legal immunity from successful lawsuits for damages under the doctrine of qualified immunity. When a cop has illegally hurt someone, he or she can count on what's known as the blue wall of silence, knowing that a fellow officer will not contradict his or her defense. What's the role of police unions regarding the protection of police who have abused and even murdered citizens? Police unions act as power brokers in opposition to the rights of victimized citizens. They provide legal defense funds, public relations, and political pressure in defense of abusive cops, and they are very powerful and they're good at it. We speak today with civil rights attorney Flint Taylor. Taylor is a founding partner of the People's Law Office in Chicago, starting out over 50 years ago representing the family of the assassinated Black Panther leader Fred Hampton. He's represented numerous police torture survivors in Chicago during the past 33 years. Taylor was one of the lawyers involved in the struggle for reparations and has chronicled the decade-long fight against police torture in his award-winning book, The Torture Machine, Racism and Violence in Chicago. Attorney Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Mike. It's always great to be with you and Heidi.
Flint, you've written that police unions operate as racist power brokers. How so?
Well, as I document in some length in that article and in previous things that I've written...
Let's stop for a second. The article was in Truth Out last week. Is that correct?
Yes. It came out just before the 4th of July, appropriately, I suppose, or ironically. And the article deals with the history of police unions, focusing on Chicago and New York, and also on all of the recent union atrocities in terms of the statements that have been made from Minneapolis across to Kentucky and everywhere where there's been police violence and murder. The union has popped up its very powerful and racist head to resist the progressive movement and the forces that are raising issues of police violence.
Let's talk about the police union in Minneapolis, the head of it. Minneapolis is a city where George Floyd, of course, was lynched, and where the precinct where his murderer worked out of was burned to the ground. I understand that the head of the union up there in Minneapolis had 30 prior complaints against him.
Well, that's Kroll, yes, and he, of course, was extremely reactionary in speaking out with regard to the murder of George Floyd and also in terms of the protests that happened after that. And he, like a lot of the leaders across the country, past and present of youth police unions, have a very deep history, not only of racism, but of police violence themselves. And he had 30 complaints. I believe he, at one point or another, and had been suspended by the Minneapolis Police Department, as has the current head of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police, is presently under suspension from the police department. So they're almost exclusively, I think, like 49 out of the 50 leaders of police unions across the country in major cities are white. The ruling bodies, predominantly, if not exclusively, are white, made up of the most reactionary and right-wing ideologue aspects of the police department.
Let's talk about Chicago, where you come from. How did the police union in Chicago operate when Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shot Loquan McDonald, a young man, in the back 16 times? This happened just recently.
Well, you have to set that, how the police union, the FOP, reacted in that instance, Loquan McDonald, with the history starting back in the 60s when the FOP came into existence in Chicago, starting with the Fred Hampton case, the Black Panther leader that was murdered in his bed in 1969, and the FOP defended those assassins all the way through all of the Chicago police torture cases, the John Burge cases, right up until Laquan McDonald, and to the present. The Chicago Police Union, the FOP, has defended the indefensible, has defended the most racist acts of police violence and murder and assassination and torture, unquestionably. And they defend it not only in the sense of standing up for the officers publicly, taking whatever kind of story, false story that they tell and running with it, but they, when necessary, finance the defense of the officers that are charged in the Burge cases, the police torture cases. When Burge was brought up on charges before the police board, the FOP paid for his lawyers. And when he was criminally charged and prosecuted in federal court, the FOP paid for his lawyers. And then you turn to Laquan McDonald, and again, the FOP paid for Van Dyke, the murderer of Laquan McDonald, paid for his lawyers during the defense. And the FOP also intimidates other police officers who have the courage to break the code of silence. In the Laquan McDonald case, there was a second case, which was the cover-up case, where three officers were charged with filing false reports. During that case, an officer or two came forward and meekly testified against the officers, and the cops packed the courtroom in that case and intimidated the witness or witnesses. And in my case, one of the recently a police torture case, the Jackie Wilson case, we had an African-American police witness who had broken the code of silence after he retired, and he came to testify on our behalf, and more than 50 FOP members mobilized at the courtroom, intimidating our witness to the degree that he wanted to back out of testimony. We were able to convince him to walk into the courtroom through a gauntlet of FOP members and take the stand and testify truthfully about Burge. But he was so scared in doing so that he enlisted the sheriff to escort him out of the courtroom and to the elevators. And these FOP members were all in their T-shirts and in their flak jackets, staring down this brave officer who came forward to testify. So the FOP is a very powerful racist organization here in the city of Chicago, who in some instances, in most instances, if believe it or not, take a position to the right of the police department itself.
The notorious Chicago police detective John Burge went to prison for crimes related to his torture of black people. How much money did the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police spend defending him? And then secondly, how much did the city council have to take out of its budget to pay the victims of his crimes?
Well, Burge was, there's several questions there in terms of the finances. We don't know exactly how much the FOP paid because they, unlike the city, you cannot FOIA them and find out how much they paid. But we know that they had the very high-powered criminal defense lawyers, both in the six-week hearing that I mentioned when Burge was fired in the 90s, and again during his month-long trial in federal court in 2010. So you have to estimate they spent millions of dollars on that little gambit. But Burge was sued repeatedly along with many of his cohorts in federal court. I was involved in several of those cases. And the city defended Burge and defended itself with private lawyers in those cases. And the city spent over $30 million, and that meter's still running because there's still some cases pending against Burge, even though he's dead, and the city for torturing people here. So it's more than $30 million to the lawyers defending Burge, and upwards of $90 million or $95 million, I think the count is now, to survivors of police torture who had lawsuits or who were given reparations here. So when you calculate all the money that has been spent defending Burge and dealing with the police torture scandal in Chicago over the decades, you get up almost to $150 million. And that's the calculations that you can do with the public information that's accessible. So a huge scandal itself, but the financial aspect to it is rather staggering as well.
Yeah, that's second city. Let's talk about New York, the first city. What about the police union in my city? What are some of the highlights, or rather I should say lowlights, of how they've operated in the last several decades in terrorizing the city and opposing a civilian review board?
Well, originally being from Boston, I'm not going to challenge you on the first city, second city characterization. I know there might be a few people in Chicago that would. But being serious about that, New York has a rich history and rich quotations around as well, going back at least to the mid-60s with the Police Benevolent Association. And every time that there was an event or a series of events of police violence, wanton police violence or systemic police violence in New York that came to light, and there would be, and as you know, always has been a very strong movement or movements against police violence and racism in New York City, the PBA would rear its head. And as early as 1966, there was a drive on for a civilian review board in New York City, and Mayor Lindsay seemed to be entertaining it, and I think it ultimately got to a referendum, and PBA went rather wild on that and did a publicity campaign that defeated that referendum. And then in the 70s, you had another situation with Mayor Beam, I think, this time, who had to get a restraining order against the PBA for demonstrations that they were staging. And they seemed to, in their demonstrations, I know in one of them, they shut down the Brooklyn Bridge, and another one, they terrorized the black and Latin communities running through the neighborhoods with their guns waving and banging on trash cans. I believe that's the one that Mayor Beam was ultimately got a restraining order against the PBA. And when African-American Mayor Dinkins was in power in the early 90s, and he was making some moves to try to combat police violence and making some noises about a civilian review board, again, there was a huge PBA demonstration. I think it might have been at City Hall. That got violent as well. It was completely racist. They had all sorts of racist slogans depicting Mayor Dinkins in a racist and derogatory way. Again, they were successful in beating back reforms that the city was putting forward at that time. Then we get to Abner Louima and the violent sexual assault and how the PBA was complicit in covering that up with the officers who conspired to attack and cover up that horrendous crime by precinct officers in New York. And then we come all the way to Eric Garner and how the Lynch, who has been the head of the PBA for decades and has been a spokesperson for right reactionary positions from the PBA for decades, how they defended Pantaleo, the chokehold killer of Eric Garner. So you can trace, and of course, presently they are resisting efforts in the state legislature, and de Blasio, the kind of moves that they're trying to make to deal with reform in some very modest way in New York City. So New York rivals Chicago, Minneapolis, and many other cities in the racist and reactionary history and current history, as well as history that goes back decades in terms of police unions supporting the most reactionary actions of police officers.
You've written that you believe that racist police violence is inherent in the institution of policing. Why is this so?
Well, I've been doing this for, over 50 years, Michael, and you see and learn certain things, and not only do you see the kind of history and you butt heads with them, you know, day in and day out in your cases, and you see the movements dealing with and being resisted by these unions, but you come to understand that the police department is, in fact, an occupying force in communities of color, in poor communities, that they're not there to be officer-friendly. They're not there in some way to solve problems, some of which they can't solve, like mental health issues, which they are asked to come, and they almost invariably end up killing or locking up people who are having mental health crises or drug issues, that kind of thing. But they actually don't prevent crime, obviously, and they don't solve crime in most instances because the community doesn't trust them. In fact, what they do is stop and frisk, they beat, and they kill, and that's because they're there to protect property. They're there to protect the interests of the capitalists or the interests of those who rule, and that becomes clear as you see most of the reforms that sometimes are implemented in the cities across the country, how they don't have an impact, how unfortunately they may stop to some degree some aspect of police violence, but the underlying causes of that violence and the fact that the police are there not to serve or protect, but rather to impose the rule of power, the rule of property in those communities. They're the front line in a whole system of injustice that starts on the street with the police and actually starts with the economic inequities in society and lack of it, you know, the educational inequities, and all we can name them one right after the other, and ends up in the mass incarceration and the prison system.
We're speaking with Chicago attorney Flint Taylor. Flint has recently written an article on police unions for Truthout, and we'll link to that. Flint, in your article in Truthout, you write that the fundamental role of the police is as agents of repression who operate as an occupying force in the communities of color and as a frontline guardian of capitalist interests. Let's talk about the demands that have been raised by the mass movement recently. Community control of the police, defunding the police, abolishing the police. What's being done in Chicago to advance the demand of community control of the police?
Well, first and foremost, what's being done to advance it is the fact that the movement for Black Lives and others in the streets consistently are demanding it. And they're demanding it, and they're writing about it, and they're talking about it, and they're talking to their people in power about it, but they're also educating about it. And in this moment or moments where the movement is such sharp focus on what the movement for Black Lives is saying and the legitimacy of what's being said, that's where it all starts. And what's being done by the movements here, and I think is mirrored in other places across the country, are making these demands. But these demands go across that range that you mentioned, which is a kind of a fabric of ultimately looking towards abolishing the police by defunding them, but not just defunding them, but moving that money to places within the city structure, economic structure, whether it be education, whether it be mental health issues, that kind of thing, so that you're not just taking money away from the police department, which has bloated, ridiculous budgets, but moving it to alternatives where you can take the police out of the schools, you can take the police out of mental health questions, you can take the police out of drug issues, that kind of thing. But ultimately, the theory and practice is that of abolishing the police and replacing it with community mechanisms for restorative and transformative justice. And that was, in the past, thought to be something, you know, rather unattainable when Angela Davis or Miriam Caba or some Ruthie Gilmore in the prison context talked about these things, that it was something that didn't seem that practical. But now, given the circumstances, it seems much more practical to talk about it and to visualize it and to work towards it. And that's what's going on in Chicago. Another concrete aspect of that is something called CPAC here in Chicago, which it's Chicago Police Accountability Council. And they have a 29-page proposal which has to do with complete community control of police, of electing people from each police district to be on a board that really has the power to hire the police superintendent, to discipline, to write regulations, to have complete transparency about police violence and about repeater cops. And it was something that is supported by 19 of the 50 Alder people before this moment happened. So that's something that's being pushed as a practical stepping stone to abolishing the police, because then you're putting the police in the hands of the people, and the people can then decide what the police do, what they don't do, how much is paid to them, that kind of thing. And that's the theory behind that, and the practice behind that is if that's implemented, then that can work as a stepping stone towards abolishing and defunding the police.
Yeah, I first heard about this when I was on a panel last winter at the People's Forum with Frank Chapman, who's one of the lead organizers in Chicago. I understand that they've got a huge amount of support in the community.
Yes, Frank is a warrior, a veteran of many struggles over the decades here in Chicago and nationally, and they do have widespread support for CPAC. But we have a lot of resistance here. We have a police, I guess that was a Freudian slip. We have a mayor who was
<That's> funny.
that was elected on kind of an outsider police reform kind of ticket, but is extremely resistant to any of the more fundamental changes that are necessary, starting with one of the issues in terms of defunding that came up before the George Floyd murders was that they're building a new $100 million cop academy so that they can better police, quote unquote. You know, the movement and had no cop academy as a slogan, and they organized against it. And then when Rahm Emanuel and Lightfoot took over, there was some hope that she might even scuttle it. But of course she didn't. And, of course, she's against defunding of police. And, of course, she is against CPAC. There is a more moderate version of community control ordinance that she is, her people are behind, which would keep control. See, ultimately, what they want to do is keep control. They want to keep the power over the police within the mayor and the police department. And that's why they raise such hell when true community control of police, which, of course, the Black Panthers raised back in the 60s and 70s. This is not new. This is something the Panthers visualized. This is something the Panthers wrote and fought for. We're back to the future, so to speak.
Flint, we're coming to an end of our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you that, do you believe that we're in a pivotal moment here?
Well, I I do, and it seems as though most people who watch this, who fight in these struggles, believe that it is a pivotal moment, but they also emphasize that it's about movements, and the movements must sustain itself because the pivotal moment in some degree in terms of the focus on it is created by a media which, you know, moves on in 24 or 48-hour news cycles. So the movements have to keep this in the public eye and have to keep the pressure on over a period of time through, you know, elections. And by through elections, I mean past the time of election and continue to demand the kinds of things that they are demanding. And I have hope that that's going to happen and make it not just a pivotal moment, but a moment that transforms not only policing, but the underlying, deals with the underlying causes that makes the police an occupying force.
Flint Taylor, attorney at the People's Law Office. Flint, how can people keep up with your work and that of your law office?
Well, as you know, Mike, I wrote a book called The Torture Machine, which is available and gets into great detail about the assassination of Fred Hampton and also the police torture cases here. The People's Law Office, of course, you can access. We have a website with a lot of the history of the office and also of the cases that we've done over the decades. So that's a couple of ways people can get in touch with me and also see some of the work that I've done.
Flint Taylor, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We're going to stay in touch because I understand you've got a significant case down in Greensboro, North Carolina, and we're going to want to talk to you when you come back with a win on that case. In the meantime, you be safe and stay well and take it easy.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Great being with you again.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Restrictions began after the New York Civil Liberties Union looked into several cases of people who were harassed, detained, and arrested by federal agents while photographing or shooting video of federal buildings from the vantage points of public plazas and sidewalks. In 2010, the New York Civil Liberties Union brought a suit against the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in federal court, challenging its practice of arresting photographers. In October of that year, a settlement was reached in which the U.S. government agreed that no federal statutes or regulations bar people from photographing the exterior of federal buildings, and the government issued a directive to members of the Federal Protective Service on photographers' rights. A decade later, these rights are being put to the test in a practice known by some as First Amendment audits. We're joined by one such First Amendment auditor whose popular YouTube channel is called Big Nick South Florida Accountability. With view counts in the millions, Nicholas Freeman joins us to talk about his work in Fort Lauderdale, where he's part of an emerging trend to educate local law enforcement about the public's right to photography. Nick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored and I appreciate it so much.
Nick, tell our listeners about your community in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and why you decided to become a First Amendment auditor.
Okay. Like many African Americans in America, I grew up in an impoverished part of my community. Even though my background was low middle class to middle class, you know, eventually I did wind up bleeding over into the lesser impoverished areas. Well, what led me to become to actually pick up a camera and started doing what I do was a couple of years ago, Stephon Clark was in the news. That was a young man, I believe, in Washington that was shot by the cops in his grandmother's backyard by holding up his cell phone. Now, I had always been a little upset about the treatment that my community were receiving from those that were sworn to serve and protect. I just didn't know how to express it, how to deal with it, how to fight back, till I came across the Stephon Clark story. And I was just, to be honest with you, I was just really, really upset. And I wanted to go on YouTube, and I just wanted to find black people running away from cops and getting away, you know, like, making cops run after them and they couldn't catch them and getting away. And I stumbled across some channels that was doing exactly what I'm doing. And I started watching them and I started being intrigued by them and really felt drawn to it. And one day I just decided, you know what? The police department is a couple of blocks away. Let me just grab my camera, go out and just see the response that I would get. And the response was exactly what I thought it would be. And it just opened up a whole can of worms for them.
I've heard the phrase, eyes don't trespass. What does that mean when auditors use that?
Meaning, as long as I'm on somewhere I'm supposed to be, you cannot stop me from looking at anything as long as I'm in public. You can't make me turn my head. You can't make me walk in another direction. I can see anything that my eyes will focus on. So you can't trespass my eyes, even if it's on private property. If it's visible from the public's view, I'm allowed to look at it.
Nick, walk us through, if you will, a typical confrontation with a police officer who asks to see your identification, even though you're filming in a public area.
Okay, well, the first thing we'll do, well, that's an intimidation tactic. For them to let you know that they have authority and power. So the first thing they would do is they'd come up and ask you, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? And of course, you know, if you don't feel like answering them, you don't have to answer them because you do have the Fifth Amendment right in this country. So if you know, you don't want to answer them, the next step would be, well, do you have any ID? And that's always an intimidation tactic. So once they ask for ID, me being knowledgeable in my state, penal code for presenting ID, always remind them that, you know, in Florida, unless I'm suspected of committing a crime, I'm about to commit a crime, or I'm in the process of committing a crime, I have absolutely no obligation or duty to present any type of information to you. And besides that, we have the Fourth Amendment right in America where, you know, we're to be secure in our papers and effects.
Do you get the line from police officers specifically that you're engaging in, quote, suspicious activity? And how do you respond to that?
All the time. Suspicious activity is just a way for them to curtail around the Fourth Amendment. And my response to that would be a suspicion of misdemeanor or felony.
What response do you get from police officers? Does that get them angrier or do they specifically answer you?
They specifically answer me, but you can still tell they're dumbfounded because the answer is always, well, it's neither. And once they acknowledge that it's neither, and then the law shields me, and they can see the shield coming completely around me. because if I'm not breaking the law and you're a law enforcer, you have absolutely no purpose at this point.
Nick, do you ever get a response from civilians who may be sometimes upset that they're included in whatever you are photographing or videoing? And what do you say to them?
Once I let them know that, you know, I'm not here to record them, that I'm only here to record public officials and their interactions with the public, if that doesn't work, then I would try to let them know that there's no expectation of privacy in public. Meaning if you're out in public, you know what, my eyes can't trespass, I can look at you, I can record you. If that doesn't work, then I would typically point out the many, many, many cameras that is in the area, buildings, in a particular location. And I would try to let them know that statistics show they walk under no less than 3,000 cameras per day.
And you're talking about surveillance cameras that are literally everywhere we may walk.
Absolutely. And I would ask you a question. When you walk into a building or you walk past a building, does those people ask your permission to record you?
No, they don't. Very good point. I'm curious, have you ever been roughed up by the police, or have they ever tried to take away your camera from you?
I have not been roughed up. Knock on wood, but I have been arrested 6 times for my activism. I have 6 acquittals because I don't cop out. I take it to trial each time. I've had my equipment taken all 6 times, and the longest it's been taken has been about 6 months. I've literally spent thousands of dollars to replace equipment that has been held in evidence.
I would imagine that you are a familiar face to many law enforcement officers. Do you think that many of them know who you are?
I would say 100% of them know who I am. Even the agencies in South Florida that I hadn't visited, when I did visit, they already was aware as to who I am and what it is that I do. And, you know, it is a blessing and a curse now, because the blessing is that now that they understand who I am and what I do, that I'm allowed to do something that I have the right to do, if that makes sense. They now allow me to do something that I've always had the right to do without any type of confrontation or harassment. However, to me, they're putting their best foot forward because it's me. But I still get information from, you know, the public that, hey, these cops are doing this, these cops are doing that. And I wonder if they're doing it because they know I'm not around. So to me, it's like it's a double-edged sword to me.
Nick, can you tell listeners about the Department of Homeland Security case where plaintiff Antonio Musumeci was arrested in November 2009 after recording with a handheld video camera a protester in a public plaza outside the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Federal Courthouse in Manhattan?
Yes, that case was a very interesting case to me because it did set, well, it didn't even set precedent. It just reaffirmed that was already American right to do so, to be a member of the free press, which means you're allowed to go out and you're allowed to observe, you're allowed to redress your government and peacefully protest in the manner that you see fit. However, once that happened, the Department of Homeland Security, the Federal Protective Services, put out a memo that auditors such as myself now routinely refer to. You would see it in your local post office. You would see it in your federal courthouses. We refer to it as Poster 7, where the Department of Homeland Security made it an edict to put it in each and every one of the federal locations. That is open to the public, that public photography for news purposes can be taken in hallways, foyers, courtyards, anywhere that the public is permitted. So by him being arrested, basically he did what auditors are doing now, is telling these law enforcement officers or agencies to know your job that you're doing. You took an oath to the Constitution. Don't just take the oath, read the Constitution. Read your memos, understand your briefings. You know, follow up on your information that you're receiving so you can better protect the public.
Why is it important to document the different types of reactions that you may get from law enforcement officers during a First Amendment audit?
Well, they make up laws. They make up laws that you're invading privacy, or you need my permission to record my image, that this is county property, without understanding that county property is public property, because there's no person named county. The people make up the county. The public makes up the county. So they say things like, this is public property, or, I mean, this is county property, this is the sheriff's office department's property. You can't record in the courthouse lobby. With the rules states you can't record in the courtrooms. It's a lot of wordplay. If you're not familiar with what they're doing, you will allow them to dominate and dictate your actions. And, you know, that defeats the purpose of what you're doing.
I understand that sometimes federal employees who work in these buildings, their reaction may be even worse sometimes than law enforcement reaction. Can you give us an example of that? And is this an important learning lesson for those employees?
It is absolutely important learning lesson for those employees, because even though they're not the enforcement part of the government, they're the representatives of the government. They're the direct link from the public to the government itself. And those are the people who should be the most knowledgeable of the things that the public should be able to have access to when it comes to a public place, a public building, public ownership of this said establishment. Say, for instance, the post office, the postal service. That is one of the most public places in America. You know, it's open to each and every individual who's in America. And these people should know that this poster that is completely displayed, prominently displayed on their poster board, allows people like myself to come in and observe them in their work or place of work, to see where my tax dollars are going to make sure that I am being represented in any way that I should be. But they're completely unaware. I like to refer to people like that as three categories of people like that. You have the one that really want to serve the public. You have the people that want to assert authority. And you have the people that want paychecks and pensions. And the paychecks and pensions are 70% of the problem. That's all they come to work for, a paycheck and pension. They don't care about the public. They don't care about community service. The only thing they want to do is come clock in, clock out, and after 20 years, live off the tax dollars for the rest of their lives.
I understand that you have a category called tyrant alert. Can you talk about some of the kinds of physical abuse police or even others engage in during First Amendment audits?
Yes. Well, the biggest problem is the threat of arrest. We consider that in the auditing community a threat of violence, because if you're going to arrest me, that means you're going to grab me, you're going to place me in shackles, you're going to move me against my will. To me and to other auditors, that's violence. That's violence against me. Plus, you're heavily armed. You have a death belt, what we refer to. And at any point, my life is in your hand. And you can decide whether I live or die. So, you know, they would grab you. They would illegally detain you. They would, you know, try to force you to sit on the ground, to stop talking, to try to tell you exactly how the situation is going to play out. Which it should be the other way around. The analogy I like to use is law enforcement or government work is the only employment in America where the employee treats the employer as the lesser of the two. See, I always refer to the term public servant. And the most prevalent line of that public servant is the servant part. Every servant has a master. Maybe harsh to say, but they're the ones who label themselves public servants. So which makes the public the masters. But it's the only occupation in America where the servant dictates to the master.
Yes, and where the servant is empowered to use force, including lethal force.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go to a local restaurant, say, you know, fast food chain, and the employee talks to the manager in that manner, the first thing the manager would do was clock out and go home. Mm. You know, but in public, we can't tell law enforcement to clock out and go home. You're no longer needed. You know, they have one of the strongest unions in America, you know, and they do everything they can to keep these people in power. So a tyrant is someone who goes above and beyond his call of duty just to enforce his will on you.
Nick, what is the walk of shame?
The walk of shame is when they come up with their chest all puffed out, breathing fire out of their noses, and the law hits them right in the face, and they turn around, and they have to walk away without doing anything that they originally set out to accomplish.
Tell us about the positive effects that First Amendment audits have done to improve police relations in your community.
Well, it has empowered the public with knowledge to understand that I'm not just, I can speak from my point of view. I am very proud to be who I am. I'm very proud to be an African-American in America. I served my country proudly, 6 years in the military. But being a citizen of America has gotten everything. So what First Amendment auditors have done is enlighten people to understand that their citizenship vastly outweighs their race. And once they take advantage and understand the power that they have in being a citizen of the United States, that, you know, they are the ones that are called the shot. They're the ones that protect their community. They're the ones that take these ill-informed people who we entrust with our public safety. I know myself personally, I have touched millions of people. I get messages all the time about how my information has saved them, how they're going to be more knowledgeable, and then find the knowledge to do what I do. So it's the information that they're receiving from me that lets me know that I am making a difference.
You have inspired many others to begin launching their own auditing channels on YouTube. What advice do you have for others who want to follow in your footsteps, Nick?
To be themselves. And also to stand firm, to be willing to take that ride. You know, I tell people all the time, a lot of problems that Americans have is that we have gotten to the point where if it don't affect me, I'm going to stay out of it. But I'm willing to take that ride so you don't have to take that ride. So you have to stand firm. You have to stand pat. You have to know what you're doing is for the greater good and that it's bigger than you. That's the first thing I had to do was understand that what I am doing is bigger than me. When I first became popular and I was getting all these accolades and people was contacting me, it went to my head. I almost had celebrity status. But because of my upbringing and the people that I have in my life, I quickly humbled myself to realize that what I'm doing is really affecting other people, and this is now bigger than I am. So the advice I would give people is to stand firm, be strong, and be willing to be a martyr so the person next to you don't have to be one.
Nick, we're going to play one or two video compilations made from your encounters. So we're going to pause to listen to a few minutes from one right now.
Okay.
What's your name and your badge number?
Officer Pitts, 3199.
Thank you. Hey, what's your name and your badge number?
Hold on. What's your name, sir? What is your name?
What crime are you suspecting me of committing?
Well, they want to trespass warn you, which they have the right to do
right.
So out there train.
So I don't need to get my name.
I'm trying to talk to you.
All right.
First of all, what
I don't want to talk though.
They need your
what's
identification.
Your name is? No.
They for the form. Yes, they do.
No. Your name is? No.
They for the form. Yes, they do. They for the form. Yes, they do.
No. By they law. Told me to leave. I left by law.
By
I left.
By law,
you can warn me.
I need your information to put in my system of trust.
No, I'm not. What crime do you suspect me of committing?
Trespassing. And I'm asking you for your information so I can write into
what
my
crime?
System.
I articulated a crime.
From the train station.
Okay, they told me to leave,
sir,
and I left. So what crime did I commit?
You have to
absolutely not. Yes. 901.151
yes.
States
give
different.
Give me your name, please.
Florida Penal Code states different.
I'm asking for your name.
Okay.
Name and date of birth, sir.
I'm not giving you my name.
What is your name and date of birth?
What's your name and your badge number?
Don't give it to him.
You have to.
No, I just get you mine.
You're
I'm the primary,
contact.
Sir. I'm the primary.
Okay, so why are they here?
Because they're my backup.
Okay,
and I'm the
I need their names.
My
in case
no.
You violate my rights, I need
well,
to know
I'm
who to contact.
I'm asking their form.
And I'm not giving
it's
it.
Gonna be Sergeant
they asked me to leave. They asked me to leave, and I left. Okay, so you don't need my information.
Do.
So you don't need, no,
they
I'm
do.
Not giving them my information. Florida Penal Code 901.
See this?
Florida Penal Code says it. I don't care.
It states that you need to provide the
first. You need to warn me what you're doing now, and I'm not under.
I have nothing to do with it.
Good. So I'm not. You can't force me to give them.
Hold on. Let me talk.
You can't force me to get my ID without breaking the law.
Well, when the police officer asks for identification,
that's not what Florida Penal Code 901-151 states. Yeah. It states suspicion of a crime, about to commit a crime, or have committed a crime.
You can hold your phone. Okay.
Am I being detained?
Well, right now, yes, you are.
For what crime?
For trespassing.
Okay.
You're in
charge of
my investigation.
I'm not obstructing. I'm talking to you.
Okay.
I need a sergeant, please.
Sergeant's coming, sir.
Thank you. And so you told them not to identify to a citizen, right?
Look, you told them with me. I'm the primary.
But they're here.
No, they have nothing to do with it. They responded to dispatch.
First of all, why are you so loud? Back up a little bit.
I'm right here.
Okay, but back up a little bit.
Because you're right next to me.
No, you walked up to me. Okay, I'm going to step a step back. I'm going to take a step back. Now, am I being detained?
Yes, you're still being detained for questions of what took place on the train.
And since I'm being detained, then at this point, I like to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Oh, my God. What took place on the train that they didn't want to trespass on you? That's what we're asking.
I don't know. Investigate them.
I did. I talked to her. But okay. I want your side of the story. Instead of,
I don't have a side.
There's two sides of a story, right?
I don't have a side. I don't answer questions, buddy.
You don't answer questions?
No.
Okay, but you have to provide ID.
No, I don't.
For an investigation, yes, you do.
Suspicion of a crime, about to commit a crime,
well,
have committed a crime.
I have it with
them. 901.151.
I know what it is, sir.
I'm an activist.
I know.
And you know I don't have to give you my information.
I see.
You know I don't have to give you my information. So all
you,
that, when a police...
First of all, you have your name for the form for them.
No, I don't, because, no, they asked me to leave, and I left. I know the law. I'm very well versed in the law.
Okay.
They told me to leave, and I left.
Okay.
So that's my warning.
Versed.
I'm very versed in the law.
Ask you, they want to put you in a system, so when we have to deal with you again, if we do, it's already there, sir.
Then that's when you get it. If I break the law, that's when you get
it. No, we put it now, so...
No, I don't like giving my name to the government for nothing.
How do you get checks? For paid, stuff like that,
I said for nothing.
For nothing, but for anything, right? So
I don't like giving my information to the government for just randomly.
Stop yelling at me.
I'm not. I can yell. I can talk. Stop freedom yelling. Of speech.
I'm asking you to stop yelling.
Do you feel threatened?
I kind of do.
Okay, then you can go.
I can't go, honestly.
You can go.
Believe me, I wish I could.
Okay.
Sir, this guy does this all the time.
I shake your hand, Sergeant. So you're not gonna shake my hand, Sergeant? You're not gonna say Hanson. What's the badge number, Hanson?
3065.
Thank you.
Hanson, 3065.
Let your dog know.
I'm not a dog, number one.
Let your dog know.
I'm not a dog,
that he can't attack me.
You
look at it.
I'm not a dog.
Hey, back off from a taxpaying law-abiding citizen.
I'm an officer.
Do not intimidate a law. You're not acting like a law. You're not acting like an officer. No, you trying to demand me to give my information to them.
They need it for their report.
I don't care, and I'm telling you, you're trying to... That's not true, Sergeant. You know what he's saying, Sergeant? When an officer asks me my name, I have to give it to him.
If you're being detained, you are.
Yes.
No, I have to be legally detained.
But you do this so often, we actually know who you are.
I have to be lawfully detained.
Have a nice day.
Lawfully detained.
Stay out of my face.
I'm not in your face. You just came right here.
Stay out of my face.
Look, see how your feet moving? Kick rocks.
Nick, how can our listeners follow your work?
Well, you can follow me on YouTube as Big Nick. South Florida Accountability. That's on YouTube. And on Instagram, it's all together, is Big Nick South Florida. And on YouTube is my first name, my surname, Nick Freeman.
Nick Freeman on Facebook. Nick, it's really been a pleasure to spend a few minutes with you. We want to thank you for the critically important work that you do and wish you the best in safety as you're out on the streets exercising your First Amendment rights. Thank you so much.
I thank you so much for having me. And with a parting shot, if I can just have your listeners to remember, always record your interactions with the government.
Words to the wise. Nick, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Be safe.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.